South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanz in Washington, working on this program via remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Friday, July 15, 2022. The U.S. Senate confirms John T. Godfrey as the United States ambassador to Sudan.
The first time we've had a U.S. ambassador confirmed by the Senate go to Sudan since 1997. I don't think it changes the substance of the relationship, but it gives us a tool to better engage the Sudanese.
And some senior South Sudanese leaders reject scientific recommendations on the proposed cleaning of the River Nam in Unity State.
We're not against dredging. Against it. The Council of Ministers has passed that dredging. We even established an institution for that process.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some senior South Sudanese officials who took part in a five-day public consultations on a proposed project to clean the tributaries of the River Nile have rejected the inclusion of recommendations that could overrule a cabinet decision on the matter. First Vice President Riek Machar, who presided over the closing ceremony of the discussions, says the cabinet is not against dredging River Nam. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
First Vice President Riek Machar says overturning earlier cabinet resolutions on a project to dredge tributaries of the River Nile shall only be done by members of the cabinet, not anyone else. Machar says during this week's public consultations on the controversial topic, cabinet members could not approve recommendations to stop dredging rivers in the Sut wetlands because that would go against the government's interests.
We're not against dredging. Against it. The Council of Ministers has passed that dredging. We even established an institution for that process.
Tempers flared between cabinet ministers and some members of the public during the public consultations as the two sides debated the pros and cons of dredging. Information Minister Michael Makwe says the government will allow the cleaning and clearance of tributaries of the Nile River in the Sut wetlands, as well as what he calls sustainable dredging.
As long as you have invited us and we have become part of the public and we are the last people who will prepare the recommendations, then it is our duty to ensure that we make the right recommendations.
Machar says the two resolutions already passed by the Council of Ministers will guide the management of the Sut wetlands.
One of the resolutions of Council of Ministers, which was the last resolution, we have gone even to a level of establishing an institution to do clearing, dredging, management of the water system. These in the resolutions we passed. So it cannot be us here to say the resolutions or the recommendations that have been passed in the consultation, public consultation with the Council of Ministers or with the Cabinet include stopping your dredging.
The consultations on dredging were sanctioned by President Kiir in an effort to ascertain the views of the public. The talks included national and international environmental experts, as well as civil society activists and lawmakers. At least 14 recommendations were generated during the first 4 days of the consultations. Chan Kwoth, a member of the organizing committee on the consultations, said one recommendation included calls to stop the dredging initiative until credible feasibility studies are conducted, a point the cabinet rejected.
Advocate for the establishment of the National Water Commission that will focus on regional and international issues as they relate to South Sudan. There is need for national record and archives on water resources. Parliament should deliberate and pass relevant laws on this. The lawmakers should give Nile water development and management a special attention during the upcoming constitution-making process.
Last Saturday, President Kiir said his administration was freezing dredging activities in the Soot wetlands until credible professional evidence-based studies are carried out on the impact of dredging on surrounding communities and the ecosystem. He said the suspension would allow time for citizens to participate in the consultative process on the initiative. Machar says although President Kiir announced the freezing of all dredging activities, his announcement can only be validated by the Council of Ministers.
Yes, he has frozen the operation, but that does not reverse the resolution of Council of Ministers. See, it doesn't reverse it. It will have to come back to the Council of Ministers, then we reverse it.
Recommendations from the public consultations have yet to be submitted to the Office of the President. Machar says South Sudan needs to dialogue with the countries in the region who have reservations on the Cooperative Framework Agreement, or CFA, a treaty of the Nile Basin Initiative governing usage of the Nile waters.
There is nobody has an interest to hurt the interests of the Sudanese on the Nile waters or the Egyptians on the Nile waters. There's no interest in that. And that must be clear because it is important for good relations between us and our neighbors.
Egypt has not ratified the Cooperative Framework Agreement, saying it has not yet fully addressed its outlined principles, rights or obligations for cooperative management and development of the Nile Basin water resources. Rather than quantifying equitable rights or water use allocations, the treaty establishes a framework to promote integrated management, sustainable development, and what it calls harmonious utilization of the water resources of the basin. It also says it will promote the conservation and protection of the basin for the benefit of present and future generations. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Some South Sudanese in Juba say the country's education system has collapsed 11 years after the country declared independence, adding that the national government has allegedly neglected the sector, which has impacted the quality of education. Some teachers say more schools have been built across the country since 2011, but the quality of education is worst. For VOA News, Viola Elias reports from Juba.
A Juba resident who prefers to remain anonymous because of reprisals from the government says South Sudan education sector was better before South Sudan separated from Sudan. He says most of South Sudan labor force and leaders completed their higher education when South Sudan was still a part of Sudan. He adds South Sudan lacks classroom and trained teachers and often face a poor learning environment which forces parents to either enroll their kids in private schools or take them to neighboring countries.
For the 11 years that we have, I've seen the educational system deteriorating, especially the government educational system is deteriorating than the private schools, because private schools, I think it's better because of the pay, and the parents also pay a good money to the school. That's why they're getting up. The environment is conducive for education, the sanitation is there.
A Juba-based high school teacher, George Kenyi, says although the government has opened more schools across the country, South Sudan has not improved the quality of education. He says part of the problem is that the government does not provide refresher training courses to improve teachers' skills. Kenyi also points out that teachers receive meager salaries and are frequently paid late.
These 11 years, I want to say, education sector, which is the one, the opener of the eyes for all the people in this society, it has been put to be the last. And we are even surprised if the people who are running this country are all products of education. You are leading a ministry, you are leading an institution because you went to school. So if one day you sat in a school, then how will you forget the sector which produced you?
Kenyi says before South Sudan declared its independence from Sudan, the government took care of teachers' needs, which prompted teachers to give students their best. He recommends the government dramatically increase funding for education.
So if the national budget gives 50% of the national budget, the education, I think also people will see wonders in the society. So you offer less. For example, you provide every student with a book, every care that people think of for every school, then you will also see products coming out without any doubt. People sometimes decide to send children to the neighboring countries. Then people start to say, education in Uganda or in Kenya is more better. It is because in Uganda and Kenya, the government turned their eyes to education and it became better. So why can't you do the same thing in your own country?
In the 2021-2022 fiscal year, 17.1% of the national budget is spent on education. Rose Adau, Deputy Chairperson of the Specialized Committee for General Education in the National Legislative Assembly, says years of conflict have eroded all sectors, including education. She acknowledges the government is concerned about the quality of education in schools across the country.
And I think this system of education,
this system of education is going to be changed. Citizens always said leaders take their children to go and study abroad, leaving poor civil servants' children here in Juba. I think it is according to individual capacity, but we are equal. So I think people shouldn't get discouraged and leave their schools because others took their children abroad. It is not of us.
Isaac Otieno, a technical education specialist with the International Children's Charity Save the Children, says South Sudan education sector faces numerous challenges, including lack of teachers' motivation, inadequately trained professional teachers, child marriages, and food shortages. Otieno says about 2.8 million South Sudanese children are out of school, 70% of whom are girls.
In most schools, especially in remote areas, we have weak school infrastructures, which continue to be a challenge for us. We have 23% of schools that are under trees, that according to Education Needs Assessment of 2021. The same needs assessment also indicates that we have 18% of schools that are non-functional. So again, also able to portray the challenges that children are having in terms of accessing a conducive environment for both teaching and learning.
Otieno says recent flooding, which contributed significantly to the humanitarian crisis in the country, displaced children from one location to another. He says Save the Children is working with the Ministry of Education to rehabilitate damaged schools and construct temporary schools for displaced children.
We've also endeavored to provide teachers incentives to be able to motivate the teachers and ensure that there is consistency in the manner in which they are attending schools, such that it's able to reflect in the teaching services in terms of content delivery and syllabus coverage to the learners, which basically translates to ensuring that there is enhanced education outcome.
The government allocated 49.2 billion South Sudanese pounds to the education sector in the 2021-2022 fiscal year budget, a 24.7 billion South Sudanese pounds increase, or about twice as much as the previous fiscal year. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Washington, where the U.S. Senate has confirmed John T. Godfrey as ambassador of the United States of America to Sudan. President Joe Biden nominated Godfrey for the post earlier this year. Ambassador Godfrey will assume the role during a rowdy time for Sudan after the October 2021 military takeover. Cameron Hudson of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies says the move is historic, but it's not clear if it will change the nature of Sudan-U.S. relations.
The first time we've had a U.S. ambassador confirmed by the Senate go to Sudan since 1997. I don't think it changes the substance of the relationship, but it gives us a tool to better engage the Sudanese. It is a new chapter in the relationship between the United States and Sudan. Whether or not it changes the substance of the relationship, I think, is yet to be determined, and that will rely, I think, largely on the Sudanese. But it's important nonetheless because it is the final stage in a process of normalization
that has been going on for several years now. And this was, I think, the final element that had not yet been put in place.
You mentioned that it's an important tool to engage Sudan. How best can Ambassador Godfrey serve his mission in Sudan, and what should be his priorities, you know, at these really uncertain times?
Well, again, he has to go to Sudan and present his credentials to a military head of state, because when he arrives in Sudan, there will likely not be a civilian leader. There will not have been an election held. So he is inheriting a very troubling portfolio. And Sudan has a very steep road ahead. It has to resolve an ongoing political crisis. It has to create a transitional government and a civilian leadership. It has to prepare for democratic elections. It has to write a constitution. I mean, Sudan is on the precipice of reinventing itself in many ways. And as the American representative in Sudan during this period, Washington remains, I think, the most influential country in Sudan still. And so there's a great deal of responsibility on the United States and Ambassador Godfrey to help bring about the changes that we want to see, but most importantly, that the Sudanese people want to see in their own country. So it's a very tall task that he has.
On the influence of the U.S. On Sudan, there are mixed signals or elements here. So the U.S. cut off assistance to Sudan following the coup in October 2021. Debt relief was suspended by the IMF and the World Bank. The U.S. Sanctioned the Central Reserve Police in Sudan. But now Washington is sending an ambassador extraordinary. How do you see these U.S.-Sudan relations at these times?
I would not try to juxtapose the sanctions and the harsh penalties that we are using right now with this idea of sending an ambassador, right? Let's remember that Washington announced that it was going to send an ambassador to Sudan 2.5 years ago. In December of 2019, Secretary Pompeo said that we would send an ambassador. It has taken Washington 2.5 years to do that. This has been in the works for that amount of time. So the timing of the ambassador is important because it will allow us, to better engage diplomatically on the ground. But it should not be viewed as somehow counteracting the other tools that we are using. In fact, I would say that having an ambassador there increases the effectiveness and the impact of all of the tools we are using, whether the sanctions, whether it's diplomatic persuasion, whether it is the suspension of assistance. Having an ambassador on the ground helps us to explain what U.S. policy is and helps to inform the future direction of U.S. policy.
What will you be looking out for after this move, the confirmation of Ambassador Godfrey?
Sudan is not waiting for Ambassador Godfrey to come. Events in the country continue to unfold. We need to see the establishment of civilian rule. We need to see the reestablishment of a transitional government in the country. There are a number of elements which need to continue to unfold. And so the way Sudan looks today likely will look rather different when Ambassador Godfrey arrives in the country.
That's Cameron Hudson of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He spoke with Nabil Biagio here in Washington. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, we hear from our listeners who follow this program every week. Stay tuned. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. We love to hear your comments on issues in this broadcast. My colleague Nabil Biagio is ready with this week's listener comments. Over to you, Nabil.
Thank you, John. We heard from many of you this week about the ongoing violence in several parts of the country, such as Majak Marco Majong from Warap State, who writes, I condemn the killing of five people in Rumbek of Lake State after a girl eloped with an unknown person. This may lead to the devaluation of the revitalized peace agreement. Otherwise, the law takes its course against those who will be found guilty. Guya Moses John, a South Sudanese refugee living in Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, says, Hi, VOA. My condolences to the family members of the late sub-chief who was killed in cold blood in eastern Equatorial State. May his soul rest in peace. Mal Adaumal in Bortown writes, Hello, John and Nabil. Both the national and eastern Equatorial governments should not hesitate to curtail the escalating tensions in Numuli and Kapoita. Why should innocent civilians lose their lives and property on the watch of their own governments? Should we conclude that our government is a failed authority? Peter Ajangayom in Block 3 of Boer Town in Jonglei State says, I hate life in this country. I wish I would have been a tree in Europe or in America rather than being a human being in South Sudan. My heart is bleeding, seeing my fellow citizens killing themselves and the government is quiet. We are losing people every day. Oh God, help us. Or have you forgotten about us? Moses Atiaba from Rumbek writes, Hi, VOA. I send a message of love and peace to all fellow citizens and our friends across South Sudan. Let us embrace one another and build on the spirit of reconciliation that has become the hallmark of our nation, South Sudan. Thomas Kuntoj in Old Fangak Payam of Jonglei State says, Hello, VOA. I am very sad to hear about the killing of a Madi chief in Numuli this week. The national and state governments must show responsibility on this killing of an innocent chief. The culprit must be brought to book and face a very serious punishment. Almighty God rest his soul in eternal peace. Manong Chuang Kujek from Juba POC one writes, Good evening, VOA News Desk. The killing of Chief Ebele in Numuli is disturbing. I condemn it because killing an innocent person who serves the community is something that needs to be seen as a criminal act. I want a judge in the area to sentence the culprit to death for the rest of his life. Maker Zakaria from Rumbek writes, I have appreciated the consideration being shown by His Excellency to stop dredging of the Nam River based on public opinions. South Sudan and its resources are ours and need our full protection. Shol Philip Kwan in Boer Town of Jonglei State says, Hello, VOA. The decision of our President Salva Kiir to suspend the dredging of River Nam and River Nile was a welcome development and congratulations to our President for a job well done, because we know very well the consequences of dredging those rivers and it should trigger the lost ecosystems and loss of fish in those rivers. Congratulations to our President for a wise decision. Mabora Latringo in Rumbek Lake State says, Hello, John Tanza. You are welcome back to the studio after a two-week break visit to Juba. It saddens me always to hear tragic killings in eastern Equatorial State by cattle herders. It is hard to keep a hyena and a goat in a cage. The hyena will end up eating the goat. So cattle and crops can't be together. Therefore, the cattle keepers must leave the land of eastern Equatorial State. And may the souls of those who perished rest in peace. Someone identifying himself as Mandela from Juba says, Good afternoon, VOA. I have a suggestion that any company who's dealing in selling motorcycles should have a tracking system to help our border guys recover their stolen motorcycles in the city. The opinions expressed here do not reflect the views of VOA or of this program. We appreciate hearing from so many of you this week. Keep those comments coming.
Send us your brief comments and we shall sample some of them every Friday. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. No democracy is complete without the participation of all its people. Therefore, those states that seek to strengthen their democracy should strive to ensure opportunity for everyone, and that must include advancing the participation of women and girls. Today, because the internet is a critical tool of participation in a wide range of endeavors, those working toward gender equality must address the scourge of online harassment and abuse targeting girls and women. Online gender-based harassment is the targeted abuse via technology against people, in most cases women, and the LGBTQ plus community based on their gender. It is a barrier to ensuring women and girls are able to reach their full potential. It consists of various acts such as misogynistic or unwanted sexual remarks, threats, cyber flashing, malicious sharing of intimate messages and photos, even cyber stalking, which are amplified or enabled by social media and technology platforms. These actions are intended to control, attack, and silence women and girls, to discourage and reduce their participation in public life. Women politicians, activists, and journalists are prime targets. Online harassment and abuse go back to the dawn of the internet age. They are rooted in entrenched gender disparities and have increased over time, facilitated by new and emerging technologies. And they are a serious threat to women's advancement because they have a chilling effect on their targets. They function as a barrier to the full and meaningful participation of women and girls in political, public, and private life, and can lead to self-censorship, even disengagement altogether. At the recently held Summit of the Americas, the governments of Canada and Chile pledged to join the United States, Australia, Denmark, New Zealand, Republic of South Korea, Sweden, Kenya, and the United Kingdom as members of the Global Partnership for Action on Gender-Based Online Harassment and Abuse. The United States announced the partnership at the first Summit for Democracy in the lead-up to the second summit in early 2023. It sends a clear signal that the international community is committed to improving the response to technology-facilitated gender-based violence and promote effective prevention strategies. We cannot afford to lose a diversity of viewpoints or women's voices, perspectives, and leadership, said Director of the White House Gender Policy Council, Jennifer Klein, particularly at a time when democracy cannot be taken for granted, with the brave women and men of Ukraine fighting to preserve theirs.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
And that's all we have for you this Friday. We'll now leave you with the song Salam by Manyang Adin.
Salam, young widow, a deal. That in Salam, not a widow, a deal. That in Salam, young widow, a deal. Salam, I left whom I twitch my yadi. Take a salam, yeah. Salam, I left whom think of ye. Take a salam. I give me a little line with her, yet you learn. I give me a little line with her, yet you learn. I give me a little line with her, yet you learn. Abi mi alli loñ mu door bi jëlloñ fu nga gëri di agon mo na kan tang mi di te yu bay ci nga ko ñu wo fu nga gëri di nga gon mo na kan tang mi di te ga ci nga ko ñu wo ko jaar ci yo bawo di nga gëri ci yo bawo ya radio ma ya di ga wati ji gon la le yo bawo ba nga mo na kan yo bawo ya radio ma ya di ga waki yu bang la le yo bawo de wan jan nyal yo bawo ya radio ma ya di ga waki yu bang la le yo bawo de ngir ti yo bawo ya radio ma ya di ga waki yu na ma yo bawo de balo bo nyar yo bawo ya radio ma ya di ga waki yu na ma yo bawo de wan na mo ring yo bawo ya radio ma ya di ga wati ji bang la le yo ba go ban mong ko la ro yo ba ga de radio ma ya di ga wati.
We have been listening to Manyang Adin and the song Salam. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for taking time to be with us this evening. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Salam alaikum, da kri mai.